I'm delighted to be here. What I thought I'd do is tell you a little bit about the subject, the WTO and the FTAA tonight, which sounds boring, but I promise it's not going to be. And then maybe we can just have a discussion afterwards. I did want to tell you that before I started on this, though, what you may or may not have heard that, because things have been so busy, that God had a very important meeting. She decided that she wanted to meet some world leaders, so she's very angry about the state of the world, so she thought she'd bring them before her and give them a piece of her mind. So she brought George Bush from the United States, and she brought Jiang Zemin from China, and she, three leaders, and she decided, now who else should I get? And she had one of those two prime ministers in Canada. I guess I'll get the one that's still there, Jean Chrétien. So she called them up, and she said, I've had it. I gave you a beautiful green and blue planet. I don't know what you've done, but I'm not going to let you take it down a piece at a time. So I am telling you now, I'm going to destroy the world in 3 days. Go home and tell your people. Well, George Bush went home and he went on national television. He said, I got good news and bad news. The good news is there's a God. I was right. The bad news is she's a woman, she's temperamental, she's mad at us, she's going to end the world in 3 days. Jiang Zemin went home and he went on national television. He said, I have bad news and even more horrible news, or just awful news. The awful news is there is a God. The even more awful news is our dream of competing with the United States as a superpower, becoming an economic superpower, isn't going to happen. Jean Chrétien went home. He went on national television. He said, I have great news and I have greater news. The great news is I'm a world leader. And the greater news is Paul Martin will never become prime minister. I'm the only person in Canada who doesn't want Jean Chrétien to leave because I'm going to lose that joke, right? I mean, I made it up. I think it's good. So there are two huge trade initiatives I want to talk to you about tonight that have to do with everything we're about. Healthcare, education, water, deep integration with the United States, the new military stuff. I've just been reading about Canada's pressure to sign on to the American ballistic defense system, which our government says, oh, we're just going to do bits of. But don't worry, we won't get into the weaponization of space. And meanwhile, Donald Rumsfeld in the States is saying, of course it's the weaponization of space. We're going to start with these missiles embedded in Canada and the U.S., but eventually they're going to be in space. And there is Son of Star Wars is on its way. And I tell you what I worry about. I worry that neither Chrétien nor Martin wants to make this decision, so it's not going to be made by either of them. It's just going to slowly be negotiated quietly between the Department of National Defense in Canada and the Pentagon, and that we will get sucked into this piece by piece. It's just the lack of level of debate about these fundamental issues is just profound in this country. And so I was happy when Vi said, come back to Guelph to speak to you between the Cancun meeting that happened in early September in Cancun, Mexico, on the WTO, and the upcoming Free Trade Area of the Americas, which is taking place in Miami, because these are two really important developments. You did not read about what happened in Cancun in your local newspaper, and that's not, if the local reporter's here, you're welcome, that's not your fault. That's because we are not taking these issues seriously. There was not one CBC reporter in Cancun, and these very important global trade talks. I mean, there were reporters from all over the world, but the CBC didn't see fit to send somebody to Cancun. I was stunned. In Seattle, the big battle of Seattle, you'll remember 99, there were three camera crews from the CBC, two from CTV, and there were a number of radio reporters, French and English. I mean, what has happened in that time period is something I think we need to really ask ourselves about, because the stakes were just as high as they were in Seattle. In fact, I would argue they're higher in the light of the unilateralist kind of position that the United States is taking around the world. So I just want to tell you about these two processes and what's at stake. Well, first of all, for the World Trade Organization, they are looking at a major, major expansion of the former
regime. You'll know now that the WTO is the world's preeminent institution for enforcing a number of trade agreements on all sorts of areas, not just good trading goods, but intellectual property and health and safety standards and agriculture and pesticides and all sorts of things that we, a lot of us, believe trade should never have been able to govern, far less enforce from another place. Was created in 1995. The first, they had a Singapore round earlier, but the first real round, what they call rounds, these are launching negotiations that go on for a number of years. The first real round was attempted to be started in Seattle. And what in 1999, and what happened was there were then, and there are now, very deep divisions between what are called the Quad, that's the United States, Canada, Europe, and Japan, and the rest of the world, which is about 80% of all of the delegates to the WTO. And those differences were there in a huge thick text when they went into Seattle that were both the symbol and the actual textual reality over which they fought and over which the talks broke down. And of course, you'll remember the huge street battles in Seattle, and the combination of people taking to the streets, not allowing them literally to have the opening of the event. Pierre Pettigrew had to, oh no, it was in Sergio Marchi, was the Canadian Trade Minister. He had to be raised in a flower box, like a pulley, up to get him up over the crowds. It was one of my happier moments watching Sergio Marchi get. You're looking good there. You're sprouting, a little sprouting flower, Sergio. So that collapsed and in total and complete failure. 3,000 journalists from around the world were there to write about the glories of free trade and the U.S. empire, right? And what they ended up writing home about was sweatshops and, you know, treatment of animals and small children and lower standards and water issues and so on. And President Clinton phoned the head of the American delegation, Charlene Barshefsky, and said, shut this circus down. Now, the next time they met was in Doha, Qatar, and boy, a bunch of things had happened between them. For one thing, they decided they were not going to meet anywhere ever again where we could, you know, 70,000, 80,000 of us could be right there in their face. So from now on and forever after, I expect, when the World Bank meets or the WTO or whatever, they meet in ways that people can't get at them. And so this has become a very important part of what they do. So they chose this emirate, this oil emirate, in on the Persian Gulf, that is where there's no free speech, absolutely no ability to have a different view than the reigning sheikh and the reigning family, the royal family. And already the prince, the crown prince, has been chosen. It's his second son. I don't know why the first one wasn't okay, but they already know the lineage and so on. Very, very, very rich oil kingdom in the middle of the desert. And they we had only about 75 of us, not government agencies, not business there, from all over the world, and 15,000 armed personnel, including the Marines. So just in case, you know, we're very dangerous, 75 people. The collective danger of our ideas must be taken care of. So that was just an amazing experience. I had to fly over in a Canadian army plane because the other thing that was different then, of course, was that 9/11 had just taken place. This was just November, just 2 months after 9/11. And so they were holding this meeting in the Middle East, and so the feeling was just, you know, the security was unbelievable. And so I was the only, you know, non-business, non-government delegate going over and coming back on this plane, so I kind of felt quite lonely on that plane. But what happened in Doha was that the United States basically let it be known to the entire world that they now had one foreign policy, and that was terrorism and the commercial interests of the United States to protect them from terrorism and their unilateral moves in terms of the military. And Robert Zoellick, the U.S. trade rep, made it very, very clear that if you were with us on terrorism, it was either with or against. They're all areas of gray faded on September 11th, and combined with September 11th and George Bush being in the White House, all areas and shades of gray disappeared. You're on our side or you're not. And Robert Zoellick went in saying, if you're on our side on terrorism, you will sign on to this new round of trade talks. If you don't agree to that, we're going to assume you're not on our side on terrorism. And so the same deep issues of division between the South and the North that existed in Seattle were still there. there in Doha, but one after another, the countries got picked off. And I've never seen quite such a brutal show of naked power in my life. And I have to tell you, the Canadian government played a horrible role. The Canadian government was what's called a friend of the chair, which is that you go out and you try to bring in recalcitrant developing countries that are not coming along. And having they extended it a day, and they didn't come in with a thick new text with all the differences. They came in with just a northern perspective, one-page text, which infuriated everybody, and bullied and cajoled and threatened in one way and another. That's how the Doha launch round was launched. Fast forward almost 2 years to this past September, and the developing countries had come back together. And if, for me, and I remember thinking, this is feels more like Seattle than Doha. There's a power that's come together here. China had come into the WTO by then, which made a huge difference. Where China was going to go was going to matter. And Brazil had a brand new president, Lula da Silva, and is no friend of globalization. So there were things that had changed, and the world was not as sympathetic to George Bush as it had been 2 years ago. Nevertheless, and here's what you need to know. They called it the Doha Development Round, but the third world countries said, you need to stop now and deal with development, because it's called the Doha Development Round. You're giving $1 billion in U.S. dollars a day in subsidies, U.S. and Europe, mostly to agribusiness that you're dumping into our markets and destroying our farmers, you know, and textiles. I mean, there are issues that you've promised to deal with. Well, not only was the northern countries not, you know, the powerful quad, they call it, not willing to do that, they were pushing what they called the new issues, which was investment, which is a multilateral agreement on investment coming back. They were pushing competition, government procurement, which is the way governments decide to spend money, want it all opened up to transnational corporate competition. And the European Union, by the way, because all the big water companies in the world, the three big ones, are all European, they were really pushing for water privatization under what's called the GATS, the General Agreement on Trade and Services. So the issues were very clear before they went in. But they thought that what had happened in Doha could happen again. They were such arrogance, it was such hubris on the side of our government and the US and the Europeans that they went in thinking, ah, the South is just posturing, it won't happen again. Well, you could feel tangibly that it was different once we got in. Something emerged that's called the Group of 21, which is a very powerful group of countries that came together, led by India, South Africa, China, and Brazil. And there's a very important group of countries that have come together to say we are going to demand a different kind of world trade system and the power balance must shift. And they came in absolutely determined. The Quad government came in again with another chairman's text and thought, well, this is going to be fine. Now, I'll shift for a minute to what happened outside, okay? Because there's always the inside and the outside. They met in these phenomenal five-star hotels. I don't know how many of you have been to Cancun, but 37 years ago, it was paradise. Nobody there. And they discovered paradise and didn't put up a parking lot. They put up a resort. I call it a tourist factory. It's just a tourist factory. There are hotels in that strip that have 9-10 restaurants in them, like each hotel. There are hotels that have layers of swimming pools. I mean, you can imagine the opulence that we're talking about, the golf courses and so on. There's no water there, by the way, speaking of water. And that's along the hotel strip. And then the city is about 700,000 people who work in the five-star hotels and the golf courses and stuff. So what they did is they put up a barricade right in the spot between where in the highway where the workers come in to service everybody, and they had 20,000 armed riot police and army security around the city to seal off this area so that they could meet in private. Well, some of us were inside and outside. I was an NGO delegate, which means nothing. It gets me in. I can't talk to anybody. I'm not allowed to do anything. But we did have lots of good protests and skits. We started off the opening day. That's all we're allowed to go to is the opening and closing. We put tape over our mouths and put up signs saying, you know, WTO shuts down dissent and so on. Anyway, but the real action was out on the streets. And the very first day, and you won't have read about this, and you should have read about this. The very first day, we had a march of about 10,000 farmers, campesinos they're called. These are people, many of whom have been displaced from around the world off their land by agricultural policies. In Mexico alone, there have been 15 million people displaced from their land over NAFTA. And even the Vicente Fox, who's now the president of Mexico, was the vice president of Coca-Cola, even he can see that there's something wrong with this NAFTA agreement and has asked that it be reopened because his farmers are dying, right? In India, farmers are committing suicide by the thousands. And these are farmers who've accepted the Monsanto answer to the world, and they're privatizing the seeds and have to pay royalty. And it's so devastating to their communities that their method of choice for suicide is to drink the Roundup Ready insecticide, the Monsanto pesticide. That's how they die, because they want, it's a symbol to say, rather than kill my land or my family or my neighbors with this, I'm going to kill myself with this. Well, there was a very powerful South Korean delegation there. They were all farmers. There were about 200 of them. They had matching outfits that were very moving. They'd all handmade, and they had the beautiful hats that you'll see, and the rice paddies in the old pictures, and the rice paddies in Korea. And they always marched together, and they had beautiful music. They had a song that we all came to kind of get to know, and they were wonderful. The head of their delegation was a man named Lee Hyung Hai. He was 56 years old and married with family. His daughter was to get married the next day. He was displaced off his farm about 10 years ago through WTO, the old GATT policies. And he's camped out in front of the WTO. He's worked as a suicide counselor in his community, where his family had rice paddies and farmed rice for centuries and centuries. They put up a shopping mall. And he was so devastated that he came all the way from South Korea with his delegation, left his bag packed in his room with a note. And on the first day of this WTO meeting, when the 10,000 campesinos marched up to the barricade, pulled the barricade down. It was very, very dramatic, and the police were going crazy trying to get recruits and new people in. Mr. Lee climbed up to the top of the barricade. He had a great big sign around his neck that said, WTO kills farmers. And Mr. Lee opened up, took the sign, he took a knife, he stabbed it in his heart. We all watched this. He rocked back and forth on the fence, on the barricade, and then he fell. And he died. Well, they took him to hospital and died about an hour later. And I'm telling you this because this was not a nut. This was not, a showman. This was a man who had come to the end of his time and the end of his rope. And he chose that time and that place, facing the WTO in their five-star hotel facilities, as a way of saying, I don't know how else to say it. I've given everything else that I can, and this all I have left is my life. But I want you to know that what they're dealing with in there is not just a set of issues around technicalities and some power struggle. This is life and death. This is about clean water. This is about livelihood. This is about health care. This is about the right to farm and the right to have a livelihood and to pass on the farm that my father and his father and his father before him passed on. I want to pass on to my daughters. In this case, he had daughters, and this was what he wanted to do, and he couldn't. And it was an incredibly powerful thing that happened, and I'm here to tell you about it because you wouldn't have read it anywhere. There was a Globe and Mail reporter from the Report on Business, and he had one line on it, said that they reported suicide, and that's all. Didn't say who he was or anything about it. That was just like, it was half a line in, the protest line was this long, and then the rest was the negotiations. What happened was we built a shrine for Mr. Lee right in the middle of the highway, and then they moved the barricade. And I give the Mexican police a great deal of credit for the thoughtfulness and the way they handled this. They moved the barricade back about a kilometer so that we had space, and it was filled with flowers, and we had vigils there every day. It was an extraordinarily moving week. Even the mainstream American press had to say what this suicide did was it galvanized this issue in terms of the fact that it's about life and death, and it became the symbol and the overriding message for us for the whole week. Mr. Lee's death became what we were doing there, right? And we marched, we had protests all week, we dropped a banner inside the convention center, which was just an amazingly scary thing to do because they built a overwalk, a kind of bridge, but a really shaky thing, over this great big highway to get into the for the delegates to get in and out of the convention center. It was just a double protection for them outside this highway. And a bunch of us got up and we unfurled a huge banner down the side of it, and we were rushed by security guards, and the thing started to sway this way over a six-lane highway, and I thought, no, that's it, that's how I'm going. But somebody just came out and said, off to those guys, let them put their banners down and let us make our speeches and stuff and let us get off. So there was there was more thought behind the Mexican security than there was in Quebec City or many, many other places that I've been. And it was very important for me to tell you that too, because this image that we're so civilized in our country and others are not, it just doesn't always bear out, let me tell you.